Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Go to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
On July 2, 1937, aviator Amelia Earhart climbed into her Lockheed 10E Electra only days away from the goal of circling the globe for the first time. It was a hot day in Leh, Papua New Guinea, as Fred Noonan, her navigator, took his position in the back of the plane behind the 6 fuel tanks that had been installed where the seats of the plane once were.
It was the most fuel ever loaded on the plane and calculated to be sufficient for the 2,500-mile trip, the longest leg of the journey. Amelia called her tight cockpit her cubbyhole. Noonan's navigation station in the rear of the plane had a clear window installed to enable him to see the stars and take readings along the way. His experience surveying the Pacific for Pan American Airways was an asset for this long Pacific Ocean crossing. In the previous 6 weeks, they had flown 20,000 miles in similar circumstances. This leg had the heaviest load of fuel ever loaded on the Electra and proved to be a hazardous, tough takeoff and slow climb after dropping at takeoff very close to the ocean waves. But it was reported that Amelia slowly climbed into the sky and out of sight. That message and others sent from Leh ground support alerted those waiting far across the Pacific at Howland Island, a speck of land 1 mile wide, 2 miles long, with only a 20-foot elevation, and where a newly built runway awaited the arrival of the Electra and the famous aviator Amelia Earhart and navigator Fred Noonan. But the plane did not arrive and was quickly reported missing. The unprecedented search that followed found nothing at all.
Part of our original 25, project guest Tom Detweiler has lived a life on the ocean, taking part in some of the biggest nautical finds in history, including the discovery of the Titanic. Tom has built a career out of becoming a historical biographer for those cases that have no ending, often finding himself on the other side of history in the modern era. Tonight, on the 56th episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, Tom makes his podcast debut via Zoom to discuss the crash and sink hypothesis, excavating the Electra in a variety of nautical environments, and his personal thoughts on why the case of Amelia Earhart, Fred Noonan, and their Lockheed Electra 10E may in fact be the holy grail of aviation. The guest I have with me tonight is part of my original 25. Anyone who follows the project knows this list. It was the list I made over a decade ago of folks that I wanted to take part in this project, and his resume speaks for itself. He has one of the most distinguished careers of anyone in the field of ocean exploration, including some cases that you may have heard of. This is going to be a good one, folks. Tom Detweiler, welcome to Chasing Earhart, sir.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
Now, I just mentioned that your resume sort of speaks for itself here, but for those that may not be familiar, can you tell us a little bit about your education and your professional background, please?
Right. I got a degree in engineering from Purdue University, electrical engineering, but knew I didn't always want to work in a factory making better integrated circuit chips or anything like that. So I saw an ad for a scientist over in marine science who wanted electrical equipment built to measure current. So I went over there and he got me interested in marine science. And then I went down to the University of Miami for ocean engineering. Just about the time that I was working in grad school, there was a major project, government project, that opened up in deep water, and I got into that. And it's been nothing but very deep water adventures since then, and I've really had a good time.
Now, do you have any early recollections of Amelia Earhart, like from when you were younger? What is it? Do you remember your earliest memories of her when you first heard of her? And when did she come into your life in a professional sense?
Well, of course, you know, we heard about Amelia Earhart in school, and I don't think I really had an appreciation at the time for what an accomplishment she really had pulled off, what a special person she was. But back in about 2000, 2001, we got introduced to Elgin Long, and he was interested in whether we could put together an expedition to go based on his theories of what had happened to Amelia Earhart. And since my company, Nauticos, had specialized in renavigation and figuring out navigational problems, we thought this would be an interesting one to take a look at. And so I really got into Amelia Earhart. And it was interesting because when I was going to Purdue University, I kept walking past Earhart Hall, and my cousin lived in Earhart Hall, but it never dawned on me who Earhart Hall was actually named for and the extreme history that she had with Purdue University. So I sort of rediscovered that history, and I really got into her background in depth as we were putting together a navigational case to try to solve where we would start to look for her.
Tom, what draws you to a case like this? Someone of your stature, you've been doing this for a very long time. You took part in finding the Titanic. You're responsible for that. What draws you to a case like Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan's Lockheed Electra Tinny?
It's got all the challenges that I like. I've looked for a number of things that other people had looked for and failed to find. I like that kind of challenge. I like the fact that you have to put together a special team, a special set of equipment and things like that to conduct this sort of search. And I like the fact that it was in deep water. Most of my career has been very deep water. So, and potentially rough terrain as well as difficult conditions for the instrumentation to operate under. So all of that was a challenge. And also it's an interesting part of the world. it's in the middle of nowhere, literally.
Yeah, let's dive right in here, no pun intended for that. But the crash and sink hypothesis is the official determination by the United States government when it comes to what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. Now, for those who don't know what that conclusion is, take us back to the morning of July 2nd, 1937, and walk us through what happened.
Well, as Amelia was approaching Holland Island, which was literally the only place out there that was prepared to receive her, had an airstrip that she could land on, although it was a relatively crude airstrip, and also had the Coast Guard cutter Itasca standing by, and fuel had been placed on the island so that they could refuel the airplane. And she had a very long leg to fly after leaving there, so it was critical that she reach this. She was going to have minimal amount of fuel by the time she got there. She had a very small reserve. And as she took off from Ley, New Guinea, she was encountering headwinds that were probably a little bit stronger than she had been told about. And there was some weather conditions over Bougainville Island, which she had to fly over. So she had to climb sooner in her flight path than she had intended to, and probably burned a little bit more fuel than she had anticipated. Also, the position of the island on her charts was plotted further to the west than it actually was. And although the Itasca knew this, that information had apparently not been relayed to Amelia. So all those things were kind of working against her, plus the fact that they had gone through conditions where it would have been difficult for them to take a sighting and know exactly what their position was until probably dawn of that morning. So as she approached the island, they did get a position. They corrected where they thought they were relative to what the position told them. And she was starting to run low on fuel. She's approaching at low altitude because there was clouds, so 1,000 feet, which is a low altitude for sighting an island, which has virtually no rise in it. And she's flying into the sun, so the visibility was limited by the fact she had the sun in her eyes. So there were a lot of things working against her. And she started to call the Itasca, trying to establish communications with the Itasca. She had difficulty getting two-way communication back and forth. She could hear them at times, they could hear her at times, but they didn't really get a good communications link established. And finally, she told them that she was flying on relatively north-south line, which is what they would have done based on where they thought the island was, said, "We think we're over the island." We're running low on fuel. And even the Itasca recorded in their logbooks that they thought she was very, very close at the time. And in fact, it was noted that they went out on deck to look for the airplane because they thought she'd be flying overhead any minute. And that was literally about the last that they heard of Amelia, was when she was flying on this north-south line saying, "We must be over the island, but we do not see you." So shortly after she was overdue to have arrived, they began to conduct a search. The Itasca left its position and went a little bit north of the island and west of the island to start its search.
And that's a perfect segue to my next question. I'd like you to maybe help me understand something and help our listeners understand something, because you just touched on it. We did an Icon episode with Chief Radio Man of the Itasca, Leo Bellarts, several episodes back. It was a three-part series we did, and he mentioned exactly what you just talked about. Actually, to Elgin Long back in 1973, he mentioned that I stepped outside. I expected to see her right on top of me, or to hear her, or see some kind of verification that she was near us, and they saw nothing, but yet they were drawing S5s constantly at that point. Can you explain to our listeners how the Itasca could be constantly drawing S5, signal strength 5s, for people who haven't been listening so far, and not see Earhart, not hear Earhart? Can you explain how they can be drawing signals that strong and her not being in any kind of eye shot or ear shot at all?
Yeah, our group at Nauticus has done a significant amount of radio work. The fellows from Rockwell are involved in our effort, and although they call themselves an amateur radio group, they're far from amateurs. They're about as professional as you can get, and have put a tremendous amount of work in this, and have matched the signal strengths that were recorded on Itasca precisely to what we think she was doing at the time, and it all matches up. What you have to remember, though, is the signal strength was relatively subjective at the time. The operator, although he was trained and had listened to lots of radio broadcasts and would make a good guess as to what the signal strength was, it was still up to the operator to record that. And so could it be possible that anticipation of this great event kind of fed into it, and that they saw a better signal than it really was? That is possible. Also, there's not a lot of background noise out there. You know, there's no other ships or airplanes or anything operating in the vicinity. So this would have been the only signal that they probably would have been receiving at the time. Atmospheric conditions can have great effect on the signal. The actual direction of the airplane has a tremendous impact, because it's a sort of directional antenna on the airplane. And so depending on which heading it's flying on relative to the island or the Itasca, the signal strength can vary. So all those things have to be factored in as to why they were hearing S5s. Now, she did move away from the island a little bit, which would correspond to flying on the north-south, but then looked like came back towards the island. So it all makes sense.
Let me ask you something, because I think it's interesting. We talk about Occam's razor in the project a lot, and we talk about that with a lot of the young folks who follow the project. You just kind of mentioned a few things about, you know, the lack of two-way radio communication. They kept missing each other. They weren't communicating. There was weather issues, atmospheric problems. There were a lot of things that seemed to kind of, a lot of little things that ended up being larger things that seemed to go wrong. Did Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan just have a really bad day?
Well, we've investigated lots of disasters over the years, and what we usually find out is there is no one factor that causes the disaster. It's usually a sum of a lot of little factors, and that's exactly what happened in this case. A lot of little things went wrong, but it all added up to be a major catastrophe.
You know, it's funny, Doug Westfall, who was one of your fellow panelists on the discussion panel we had a few weeks ago, I like the way he does this. He, when it comes to finding Howland Island, he says, with our talks with kids as well, is we'll go out there and we'll tell kids, okay, we'll take it like a pen, and we'll lay a pen or a pencil on the ground, and we'll have, you know, we'll tell the kid that, okay, walk about, you know, three houses down and lay your head on the cement and tell me if you can see that pencil. And then now walk a block down and tell me if you can see that pencil. And I love that analogy, because can you explain just how difficult, because everybody seems to agree, the folks at Tiger, a lot of the folks in Crash Sync seem to agree, even the Japanese capture folks think, That island was extremely difficult to find. Can you give our listeners a little bit of an idea of how tough that task was for Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan that morning?
I'm going to steal that analogy when I start talking to kids. That's a great demonstration.
It is. It is. It really is. And it works. And it really gives the kids, because, you know, obviously they're visual, but it gives kids an idea of like, look at this is how tough it was for them to find this island. And I would love for you to talk about, you know, just kind of just that in and of itself. How hard was it to find Howland Island?
It's a very applicable demonstration, because that's exactly how hard it is to find. We've been out there in the vicinity of Howland Island with ships numerous times, and we can never see the island from the ship. There is just nothing on the horizon to distinguish the island versus the horizon. Last time we were out there, we flew drones over the island, because you're not allowed to land on the island. So we flew drones over it. And it's even tough for the drone to see it until it's very, very close to it. There is no contrast to the island. The coloring is very similar to what the horizon looks like across the whole ocean. So there's no visual contrast. There's no height to the island at all. And when she had the sun in her eyes, that would have made it all the more difficult. And the pilots who have recreated her flight have all had trouble as they flew over, except on a very, very clear day. And we know that for a fact that this was not a clear day. She was not able to get above 1,000 feet. So she had a lot going against her that would have limited the distance that she would have seen the island at. Also, the airplane itself does not have great visibility from the cockpit. So, you know, it's very possible it could have been below her nose and she wasn't able to see it. Or, you know, as she's looking out, say, the right side of the airplane, she's looking across the engine cowling and makes it tough to see it. So, you know, there's a lot of things that could have worked against her.
What are the depths, just for clarification purposes, what are the depths of the ocean in that area of Howland Island, the vicinity?
Well, these islands rise very abruptly from the bottom. And so there's very steep slopes going off the island. So very quickly, you arrive at depths of 5,000 meters or, you know, 17,000 feet. It gets steep very rapidly. And it's also a very rough terrain on the bottom. You have little mountains and craters and, you know, all sorts of volcanic activity going on down there. So it makes for a very rough bottom and a very deep bottom.
What, and I won't ask you to give any details of the search that you've been involved with, you know, FS classified information, but can you give us an idea of roughly how far down Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan's Lockheed Electra would sit, hypothetically?
I mean, we think that it's quite likely she's going to be at 5,000 meters or perhaps even deeper. There are parts of the area that go down to 6,000 meters.
Is the plane in relatively good shape? Can you hypothesize on what shape you guys would find the plane in? Would it, people have argued that the depths of that, or those depths would keep the plane relatively in remarkable shape if she was able to put it down successfully without destroying the plane?
We think it will be in good shape because, first of all, if you have a very high-speed aircraft crash, the aircraft does break apart significantly. It's very unlikely that that happened. She would have known she was running out of fuel. She would have tried everything she could do to control it. Even if she wasn't able to do a perfect pancake landing, it wouldn't have been a high-velocity landing. And so we think the airplane would have stayed pretty much together. It was a very strong airplane. It's one of the reasons she chose it. It was one of the strongest airplanes built at the time. And so although there might be some slight damage at impact, you may have some pieces come off, like, say, a landing gear, although she may have had the landing gear up. They're going to be in close proximity, but the fuselage itself is going to remain mostly together. And because it's in deep water, we think it should be relatively preserved. Deep water generally has a bunch of preserving factors in that there's a lack of oxygen, so you get very little corrosion, that sort of thing. You don't have the animal life down there or anything that can convert the metals to other forms that, like you see on Titanic. So we think that it will be in fairly strong and good shape and potentially recoverable.
Regarding the flying at 1,000 feet, do you think, and this is, again, this is total speculation, I know, but do you think she knew, I mean, obviously she knew she was running low on fuel. They were getting into the mode of desperation at that point because they hadn't heard back from the Itasca. They weren't able to get two-way communication. She flew below the clouds, but do you think that she knew ultimately, look, we're going to crash. We're not going to make it.
And so she flew to 1,000 feet. She had to drop slowly to put that thing down. Do you think that was in her mindset that I got to put this thing in the water and this is what I got to do to make that happen?
Every pilot is trained for that. You know, one thing that you do, and I'm a pilot myself, one thing that you always do is you simulate, you know, what happens when your engines fail, and you know, your instructor will pull the throttle on the engine so that you have to find a field, line up on it, get the airplane into a mode that you can land it safely. And so as a pilot, I have to believe that she would have done that. And at some point, she knew she was beyond the point of any other thing but crashing in the ocean. And so she would have lined the plane up so that she could have landed it as best she could.
Don Fogel, who helped design her plane, told Doug Westfall that this plane was like a ping pong ball with wings. I wonder if you could talk about what condition that plane would have had to be in when it hit the water. I know it depends on whether or not something was punctured, but would this plane have floated for a while if it hit the water, or would it have gone down right away?
I think it would have sunk almost immediately. And the reason being that the engine is very heavy on those, and it's very far forward. So the plane itself is very nose heavy, and would start to tilt over relatively quickly. Of course, the plane is not built to be waterproof. It would have, I think, started to take on water fairly quickly. There are some things could have accelerated that as well. We've been told there's a weak spot in the fuselage just below the nose of the cockpit, and perhaps that would have been smashed out upon landing, so there might have been a more rapid ingress of water. But ultimately, it would nose over and start to go under.
So let's describe what we're dealing with here. Now, we're going to use this for comparison. I know it's not anywhere near the same size, but this will give people an idea. The Titanic measured at just under 883 feet in length and had a gross tonnage of 46,328 tons. No doubt the largest ship of the time. Amelia and Fred's Lockheed Electra measured at just under 39 feet in length and weighs under 6,500 pounds empty. If, in fact, it sits, as we speak, at around 18,000 feet or wherever the actual landing is beneath the surface of the Pacific, is this, given the size of the plane, is this nearly an impossibility to locate?
No, you know, I've spent my career looking for things in the deep ocean, and we've found many things much, much smaller than this airplane. And it's just a matter of adjusting the parameters that you're operating your equipment at. You know, you shorten the length that your side scan sonar is going out, you increase the frequency, so that can see smaller things. You're getting more pings on it as you go by, that sort of thing. So we would just adjust the parameters. And when we conduct a search for something like Amelia, generally what I do is assume that it did break apart, because I want to make sure I don't miss anything. So rather than looking for something the full size of the fuselage, I think about the major pieces. Oftentimes a tail will break off. So you'll have the whole tail, or you'll have engines that will break off, and you'll have those, or you'll have landing gear. So I set my parameters generally to look for those types of items, something that's a couple meters in size in general. And so we know that we're not missing anything, even if the plane has broken apart. And then we adjust our track spacing so that we get overlap, to make sure that we're looking at it from different angles, and we're not going to miss it because we only got one view and it was a poor view of it.
Now, I know you can't speak for Nauticos at this point, but in your eyes personally, is this particular aircraft the holy grail of aviation?
I would have said that 2 years ago, but we now have another holy grail as well, and that's the MH370, the Malaysian airliner that went missing. And the amount of area that's been searched and the amount of money that's been spent searching for that airplane is incredible. It's very, very necessary that we find that airplane, because we still don't know whether it was a terrorist act, whether it was a pilot who went crazy. We don't know. And we don't think it's an airline malfunction, but it could be. We don't know that either. And so it's very important to find that airliner, not only for the human aspect to bring closure to those families, but for the safety of aviation overall. So at the moment, that is a holy grail as well.
Many of the hypotheses regarding this case in particular center around the Electra resting in a body of water, whether it's 18,000 feet down, like we've been talking about today, whether it's off the shores of Nikumaroro, or in less than 100 feet of clear blue Pacific in Buka. Are the rules of extraction vastly different depending on what nautical environment you're dealing with?
They are. If you're in the deep water, generally that's considered international waters or open ocean. And there's very little regulation on actually conducting a search and finding something like this. You do have the International Seabed Authority who monitors, you know, like extraction of minerals and things in deep water, but they really don't get involved in cases like this in general. If it's in shallow water, though, that implies that it's in somebody's territorial waters. So now you have to deal with whoever that somebody is, whether it's a country or territory, whatever. You have to deal with the controlling government out there in the Pacific Islands. You also have to deal sometimes with tribal structures. You'll have the local chief who's got to give his blessing as well as the local government. And you got to make sure that you satisfy the locals who make their living on near shore fishing or things like that. You got to make sure you're not upsetting what they do. And so you've got to deal with all these different entities first. You've got to come up with a plan that's going to explain to them how you're going to go about finding and extracting and what impact it may potentially has. That has to be defined.
Is there, speaking of someone who was, you know, who assisted and really was really responsible for helping find the Titanic, and that was such a big case as well, obviously, historical, just massive historical and intrinsic value. Does a case like the Amelia Earhart case, I guess my question is the historic and intrinsic value that it carries with it, does that change anything with the way you do business? Or is it, you know, because you have media, you have all this stuff that's just going to hit you as soon as you guys look for this plane, or even if you find it. What does that do? What are the implications of that aspect of it?
Well, yeah, it makes it very important that, you know, even when before you go out on your first operation, you have to have a media plan in place. It's going to be big news as soon as you find it, and you've got to be prepared to deal with that. It's actually something that Woods Hole Oceanographic failed on with Titanic. They never anticipated how big that was going to be. And then the U.S. Navy had to step in and bring all their PR people into play in order to help handle the explosion that it was. So you got to have that in place. You also have to have security in place. Being out in the middle of the ocean, it's not impossible to think of somebody going out there just simply with a simple drag net and drag the area to see what artifact they can recover. And I've had it happen to me. So you've got to have those things in place and be prepared to protect the site because of its historical and cultural significance.
Now, I want to ask you about coral. When an aircraft is potentially covered in coral or a coral's in play, let's just say that, like in some of these hypotheses, how does that affect the extraction process, just that single aspect?
Well, just the fact that it's in the kinds of waters that coral grows in, now you've got to worry about the structural integrity of the airplane. It certainly will have been broken down by the elements. And so recovery becomes a lot more difficult. Airplanes are generally strong. They're made to be lifted from certain key points, but you know those points could have been significantly weakened by the factors that come into play in shallow water. The coral itself will start to break it down. The other thing is, you know, around the world, there is a significant movement to protect coral. And so you want to minimize the impact that you're going to have on whatever coral reef it's encased in now. And you're going to have to figure that out in advance. You're going to have to make sure, you know, if you find an airplane, you're going to have to make sure it's the right airplane before you propose an extraction of it, because you don't want to destroy a reef for nothing if you don't have to. And you want to minimize the area that you have to impact. It's going to be a much more difficult recovery in some ways if it is in shallow water encrusted in coral.
Yeah. Now let's move to extraction, because let's say we'll go off the shores of Howland Island. If this thing is found, or when this thing is found, what is that? Take me through that process. So with Titanic, you had to get eyes on it and actually confirm that you just mentioned, you know, regarding coral, but you had to confirm that it was in fact the wreckage you were looking for, that this was, you know, a positively identifiable as Titanic. Can you walk us through the process of how you would positively identify the Electra, and take us through what that process of extraction is from positive identification to bringing to the surface?
Well, those of us with a lot of sonar experience can really mostly tell from the sonar image that it's positively the target that we're looking for. We should be able to identify the electra from the sonar. However, to laymen, that sonar image is never proof. So we always go back with a camera run, and we take as many photos as possible, hopefully of the entire airplane. We can mosaic those photos together so that you have a very convincing piece of evidence showing the entire airplane. But of course, we'll go in and look for details too. You know, if there's a small item that will potentially have a number on it, like many parts on an airplane do, we may bring back that item. It helps establish rights to the wreck, and also the number would be positive proof. So the recovery at that point will be limited strictly to those small pieces, though, that will be identifying factors. And then we will bring that back, you know, prove to the world that it is the plane, and then come up with a plan for recovery. And you know, it's got to be a pretty detailed plan. We got to make sure we have all the equipment on board, because it's a long ways to get out there. You can't come back, go to the hardware store for a small piece that you forgot. And we also have to be prepared to deal with the airplane once it comes to the surface, because we've now taken it out of an oxygen-free environment into a very oxygen-rich environment, and corrosion will start very rapidly, almost immediately, upon exposure to the air. So we've got to be prepared to deal with that on deck, meaning the plane is probably going to have to either be immersed or constantly wetted with salt water. We're going to have to do our best effort and then try to get it to a facility that has potentially or hopefully already been constructed somewhere that's going to receive this airplane, where it then can go into the proper conservation mode. And that will probably involve a very deep water simulation of the conditions it came out of. So it'll be a large tank capable of receiving the entire airplane with water that we can slowly extract the salt from. And that's the process at that point, is you have to remove salt from the water at a very slow rate. It took a number of years for the salt to infuse into the airplane. It's now part of the structure of the airplane, and we got to have those salt crystals come out. If you don't, salt crystals themselves can actually break apart the airplane. And so it's difficult and expensive. Oftentimes these recovery operations grossly underestimate the cost of what the preservation is going to be. Oftentimes it's as much as the recovery itself.
The area that you guys are searching, I know you can't really give specifics, but you know, this, it's, pardon my French, it's a big ass ocean. There's a lot of area there. What techniques do you use to narrow down what you believe to be the area that the plane may be in? I mean, what is that? How does that work?
Well, one of the things that Nauticus was a specialist in is what we call renavigation. And in the case of renavigation, we used a really extensive Kalman filter, which is just it's a digital filter where you input all sorts of factors. You put a weighting on each of those factors, and it puts all those factors together and comes up with a solution or possibly multiple solutions, and gives a percentage on those solutions. And so that's what we've done over the years. We've taken all the factors that were brought to us, and ones that we've gone on to find, and other studies that we've done, and we keep refining that filter, and we keep coming up with a refined position, and then go out and search the high probability areas.
What has this whole process been like for you? Because are you guys going to be going out again? What's kind of the process that you guys are working with now on this? I mean, as much as you can speak to it, of course, without giving too much detail, but what is the process next for you guys in this particular case?
Well, we actually had a expedition just last year. With that expedition, along with the others we've conducted previously, we have covered our high probability area, a very high probability area. There is probability that she can be outside of that area, though. It doesn't drop off to zero when you get to the borders of that area. And so there is a smaller probability. That just means there's one of the factors that's weighted wrong, or it means there's something we didn't know about the last few minutes. but it probably means she's not very far out of that area. And so our next steps are to get together and, you know, bring any new information anybody's discovered to the table and figure out, well, where could we have made our mistake, and start to extend the search area in the direction that we think is most likely.
If the plane is found in the bottom of the ocean, what would you like to see personally happen to the plane once you located it and positively identified it?
Well, I certainly, you know, there's a lot of people who say, leave it alone. There's a lot of people, we had the same arguments with Titanic. I personally believe that that airplane belongs to the people. I think it's our duty at this point to finish the story of Amelia Earhart, to bring to the world what a magnificent person she was, you know, the accomplishments that she did at that time period when it was very difficult for a woman to do those sorts of things. I mean, she must have been an incredible person. When you read the stories about the impact she had on young women's lives at Purdue University and things like that, you know, so it's our obligation now to tell that story, to finish that story. And so the best way to do that is to have something tangible in front of the people so that they can relate to the story, and there would be nothing better than the airplane. And what I would like to see is that when it goes into preservation, that's actually an exhibit that people go to the preservation, they're able to look in the tank and see the airplane and see the difficulty that we're going through to preserve this. And then we can tell our story as to why it's so important to us to preserve it. And ultimately, I hope the airplane is stabilized enough that it can be on display hanging in the Uwe-Hase Center or someplace like that.
You know, I was talking with Bill Snavely a few weeks ago, who you knew from the panel, and I was talking to him about the Buca plane, the Buca wreckage that he's currently investigating. And I told him that, you know, look, whether it's you that finds it, whether it's, you know, someone else that finds it, whoever really finds the plane and brings the plane home really gets to sort of be their Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan's sort of biographer of sorts. You know, you get to basically tell right. the end of their story. And I told him, you know, this it's a supreme honor. And I think it's interesting what you mentioned. It kind of ties into what I was talking about with Bill. It's really kind of it's a big task, and it's a really big privilege, you know, for lack of a better term.
One thing I always try to correct people on is oftentimes they say, leave it alone if somebody died on it because it's a gravesite. And that's not true. It's an accident site. And if you see an accident site alongside of the road, the investigators are responsible to come in and explain how that accident happened. And that will be our responsibility. When you find the airplane, no matter where it is, and my mind is open, it can be other places as well. You now have an obligation to explain what happened, how did it get there, and to explain the last moments of Amelia Earhart. Her story is unfinished at this point, and we need to finish it.
And that's a perfect segue into the final question before we wrap up here. And I know you touched on her impact a little bit, but can you put into words what her impact and legacy is 81 years after she disappeared? And tell me, why does everybody care so much about the fate of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan?
I actually think that her impact may increase upon finding her, because we will revitalize the story. And I think people will really discover a lot of things about Amelia that they didn't know prior to this. You know, I think it's been a lot of misinformation about Amelia, about some people have said she was a poor pilot. She obviously wasn't a poor pilot. She did some pretty incredible things in her flight career. There's been stories about Fred Noonan, but, you know, if you look at Fred Noonan's record, he was hired to, you know, out of the Merchant Marine to then instruct Pan Am pilots how to navigate an airplane around the world as they were venturing out into these faraway places. So he must have been one heck of a navigator. And to have gotten as far as they did in this trip was quite an accomplishment. So I think people are going to find these were probably some pretty incredible characters. And the fact that she influenced lots of people outside of flying, you know, that she did influence a lot of young women to go in and try things that they wouldn't have thought were open to women at the time, that sort of thing. And I think it's good, because we're at a point in our history where I think finding examples like this for women is very, very important. We had three of the most impressive young women on the panel that I've ever met. And I just can't say enough about the good that they're doing right now. And this will only be further ammunition to help them do their job and to encourage other young women to get out there and do just anything they they want to do. And I think the timing is good for it.
Tom, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast today with me.
Thank you, Chris. It's been fun for me as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Crash and Sync retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarrus Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.